Okay, well, hello everyone, and welcome to the Art, Architecture and International Law seminar series at the Lauter Park Centre for International Law. I am delighted to introduce today's speaker, Professor Babatunde Fagbaibo. Babatunde is a professor in law at the University of South Africa. In 2014, he was recognised by the Young People in International Affairs as one of the top 35 Africans under the age of 35 for his research in the field of supranational regionalism in Africa. In addition to his work on regional integration law, he has written widely on the topic of pedagogy, on the teaching of international law, and today he will be speaking on choral intervention, situating the role of music in reshaping international law in Africa. He will speak for about 35 minutes or so there'll be plenty of time for questions and comments and discussion at the end. However, you don't need to wait until the very end to ask your question. If you take a look at the bottom of your screen, you'll see a Q&A box where you can type in your question at any time. So with that, Babatunde, thank you very much, and I hand over to you.
Oh, thank you, Sandesh. Thank you. And also, I am delighted to be delivering this lecture tonight as part of the Art, Architecture and International Law series. This is a topic I've been working on for some time now, and a topic very dear to my heart, because as I was actually telling you before we started the lecture, that it's always fascinating to be able to kind of marry your interests, you know, bringing music is something I enjoy, and many people enjoy, and be able to kind of understand the linkages and see the nexus between that and also international law, which I teach and I write about. So it's a pleasure to do that. I will be reading the lecture tonight, of course, after that, I would be very glad to answer questions and get further insights from participants. So the subject matter of my presentation tonight is one that has been part of my research for a while, and it all started with my consideration of the songs of the radical Nigerian musician and originator of Afrobeat music genre, Fela Anikola Pokuti. I looked at three of his songs, International Thief Thief, or as we say in Nigeria, International Thief Thief, Beasts of No Nation, and Teacher Don't Teach Me Nonsense. And I looked at how they provided instructive materials for rethinking and critically re-engaging the pedagogy of international law in African universities. This is the position I intend to build on tonight. The idea of establishing a link between music and international law is not a topic that typically excites scholars and practitioners, whether in its Eurocentric slash colonial or critical slash decolonial posture. Scholarly engagement with international law is often devoted to the so-called hard issues, such as global security, global warming, poverty, reforms of international institutions, global governance architecture, et cetera, et cetera. As such, the notion that music in its expressive and aesthetic manifestations can even be deployed in the better understanding of and finding solutions to the so-called hard issues of international law remain a peripheral subject. This is despite the views of international law scholars, such as the Indian scholar Bhupinder Chimni, who have argued, rightly so, that music is one of the important tools that can assist in capturing the imagination of new participants in the international law arena. And this position actually speaks to the prospect of democratizing the ecosystem of international law, thereby giving practical effect to the idea of international law from below. In my view, there are two reasons why I think that international legal scholars and policymakers have really not taken serious attention or paid serious attention to music as a tool for addressing the challenges of the international system. One is that music is not seen beyond its entertainment feel-good value. You know, many people want music to just remain where it is. You know, let's enjoy it and, you know, don't bring it into you know, serious things, so to speak. But this is actually not the case. For example, in the field of criminal law or criminology, there's been a relative appreciation of the role of popular music, for example, in understanding the law in this field. For example, the American scholar Paul Butler has shown how hip-hop can serve as a tool for rethinking and reforming the ideological framing of crime punishment in the US. In fact, he proposed what he called hip-hop jurisprudence on how to rethink the racial and the racist judicial system, criminal justice system in the US. More than music, literary works have actually been used in deconstructing and understanding the law. So for example, a typical example would be the special issue of the Journal of International Dispute Settlement, volume 2018, which was dedicated to the works of Shakespeare and on understanding how we could use Shakespeare to understand the nuances of international dispute settlements. In the African context, two examples are important here. Chris Givers, for example, has shown how the works of Chinua Achebe and Ngugi Wa Thiong'o could actually be used, or what critical international law could learn from the work, the literary works of scholar, of those writers. Farida Banda, in a recent book, again, has actually looked at how literary works, for example, short stories, novels, poetry, could also be used in understanding the plight of African migrants and asylum seekers. Outside the field of law, disciplines such as psychology, psychiatry, sports science, and businesses have all explored the therapeutic and progressive role of music. So law actually has a lot to learn from those fields. The second reason why music has also not been given serious attention in the field of international legal scholarship is this conservative approach that continues to see law in some sort of disciplinary isolation. So, you know, the idea of legal formalism that says law is distant from social and political processes. Law must be studied in a very rigid, kind of isolated form. An example here was an article written by a US judge, Richard Posner, in 1986, where he flatly rejected any notion of using literary works to understanding the law or interpreting the law. His argument was that, you know, these are two different fields, two distinct fields with specific and non-transferable techniques of production and presentation. So the idea of bringing them into or kind of aligning them is actually futile. But again, before I get into this lecture, I think I need to make some brief clarifications. The first is this, my choice of music is basically an extratextual, I mean, understanding that music is one of the extratextual materials or complementary materials that could be used in engaging international law. So I do not propose that we replace textual materials in classrooms with music, especially the critical ones. I think we still need to keep those, right? Then secondly, music in the context of this lecture refers to socially conscious songs. I mean, songs that have ideological similarities to critical approaches to international law, to the 12 movement, third world approaches to international law, and the critical race theory. So I've aligned myself to that kind of ideology with my choice of music as a tool. And lastly, my choice of music is one that sees itself as a challenge to the self-contained esoteric conception of mainstream international law. In this respect, it highlights the importance of centering multi-inter-transdisciplinary thinking. And this is, again, is not new to Africa. Authors, writers such as Daniel Buderi have actually shown that in the African context, the understanding of education in the African context is one that is interdisciplinary, that is the one that sees knowledge system as conjoined rather than disjointed intellectual arenas. attendees, participants, my task tonight is to invite you to reimagine international law, especially the imperative of rescuing it from its Eurocentric attachment through music. So we will go on a voyage of seeing how music could assist in this. To borrow Gary Simpson's assertion, I too want to make a plea for the sentimental life of international law. This sentimental life I refer to is not it should be seen beyond a narrow conception, one that patronizingly places sole emphasis on the theatrics or sees the inclusion of music as just a decorative exercise. No, the sentimental life I refer to here is one that seriously questions the rigidity and esoteric presentation of international law as a lifeless abstract discipline. It calls for wholeness of approach, a renewed preoccupation with what Gary Simpson rightly described as, and I quote him, an attentiveness to the unseen and unheard, or seemingly insubstantial, or a commitment to an international law of style and love and smallness, and an attentiveness to the everyday and to the informalities of power. Francis Nyamjo regards this kind of approach as what he calls the appreciation of incompleteness. That is, we need to see our world, and I quote him, a world of universe, of myriad interconnections, of sentient incomplete beings and actors, human and non-human, natural and supernatural, amenable and not amenable to perception through our senses. I do not intend to sing tonight, participants, because I do not have the skill. I wish I had the skill. It would have made my life extremely easier. I would have composed the song and even danced to it. And I think I'm also mindful of what Elvis Costello had said. And I quote him, he says, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. It's a really stupid thing to want to do. So again, I'm not writing about the technicalities or the techniques of these songs I want to talk about. I respectfully leave that to experts. They can do a better job regarding that. But my goal here is just to show that multiple roads can lead to the marketplace of ideas and approaches. If we accept that an artist is someone who, in the words of Chinua Achebe, is a human being with heightened sensitivities, aware of the faintest nuances of injustices in human relations, I think we can then all agree that in a field of international law where we have excluded the voice or the voices of musicians is actually a poor one, an incomplete one. So we need to make it complete. We need to make it whole. Now I move to just a brief historical excursus, understand the role or the link between music and the law in general, and music and international law in particular. For centuries, there's been intimate link between law and music. Every civilization can actually attest and can show how music has actually been used as a tool for transcribing or for presenting the law, be it the Greek civilization or even the Indian civilization. So for example, in the memorized, in ancient India, the memorized law code of Manu was often recited to citizens through musical chants, and which is very similar to what happened in the situation in ancient Greece, where the idea is that when we recite this through chants, it will be retained in the memories of people. It's easier to transmit or to present law in that format. So you see how the societies have actually used law and music as a medium of gauging the tempo of society, and also as an instrument for envisioning and implementing societal order. And that is why Plato, for example, was very clear to say, we have to be very careful of musicians. In fact, we have to be very careful of when there is any new musical innovation, because it is dangerous. It can inspire people to rise against the government. Suffice to note that this point is not lost on many past and present dictators across the globe. We've seen musicians being jailed, being killed, being maimed for singing against dictatorship. In the Chinese civilization, music was also seen as an instrument for perfecting normative values of a society through cultivation of character. In this regard, Confucius, for example, had noted that, and I quote him, "Let the character be formed by the poet, established by the laws of right behavior, and perfected by music." Another ancient Chinese philosopher who followed building on Confucius wrote in a book called The Theory of Music, Shunji. He later expanded on this by saying that to rule with music can publicize morality, make citizens healthy and peaceful, transform social customs, and bring peace to a country. In the African context, music has always played a significant role in societal configuration. Across ethnic groupings and societies in Africa, music served as a pedagogical mechanism for transmitting people's lived cultural realities. In, for example, in pre-colonial African Yoruba communities, music functioned as a dissenting tool for exposing misrule and dictatorial tendencies of a ruler. In fact, there's a saying in ancient Yoruba land that the king does not kill musicians because they are meant to actually transmit the truth of society. Among ethnic groups such as the Doma people in present-day North Central Nigeria and Watutsis in present-day Burundi and Rwanda, traditional judicial processes were carried out in what Wole Soyinka described as a semi-choric pattern with a predominantly theatric settings. So litigants, plaintiffs and defendants who present their cases through music in such societies. In contemporary times, the link between music and international law can be gleaned through several prisms. The most obvious is the musical expression of the problems of international law and the international system. In Africa, Asia, and Latin America, music played an essential role in the fight against colonialism, the celebration of independence, and the articulation of self-reliant development and approaches to governance. In this contemporary context, music continues to serve as a tool for exposing dictatorship, mismanagement, and collusion between national elites and foreign actors in new imperial activities. International institutions have also recognized the role of music. So UNESCO, for example, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, Cultural Organization in 2018 designated reggae as an intangible cultural heritage and treasure that is considered worthy of protecting and promoting. Similarly, in 2011, UNESCO proclaimed 30th of April as International Jazz Day. It highlighted the critical role of jazz as an education tool, a source of intercultural dialogue and mutual tolerance, and a vector for freedom of expression and creativity. Similarly, bringing it to Africa, the African Union, under Aspiration 5 of its Agenda 2063, has emphasized the role Africa's rich cultural heritage plays in enhancing political and economic integration. The AU has actually declared this year as the year of promotion of promoting and protecting Africa's cultural heritage, of which music is an important component. Lastly, I think it's very important that I say that while music has also played a very good could be a good good force, it could also be used as a very dangerous instrument and. International law actually has been called to actually respond to the culpability of music or musicians in the commission of international crimes. One such example is the indictment of the late Rwandan musician Simon Bikindi, the prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda (ICTR) had indicted Bikindi for composing, singing, and distributing songs that incited genocidal acts in 1994. The prosecutor cited the song Nanga Aba Hutu, I Hate These Hutus, in which Bikindi criticized Hutus that supported Tutsis against the government. Although the ICTR convicted Bikindi for incitement to commit genocide and sentenced him to 15 years imprisonment, this conviction was not based on the songs, but rather on a speech he had made regarding the extermination of all Tutsis. And the court held that while this song may be considered insightful, they were composed before 1994, and that there was not enough proof that the accused was involved in the dissemination of the songs during the genocide. Even if controversial, The implication of this judgment is that in the future, an international court could actually be called to convict where there's enough proof, a musician that has used his or her music as a tool for the commission of an international crime. Now I turn to what I call the ballads of dissent. That is the songs that have been used to challenge the international system or the international law. Genres such as reggae, hip-hop, jazz, Afrobeat, and Afrobeats have addressed the problem of international law and international system. These ballads of dissent raise critical issues such as the reform of the global system and institutions, racism, illicit financial flows, corruption, environmental justice, poverty, internal displacement, refugee and migration, human rights, and neocolonialism. They have been able to present this complex and dynamics and issues in a simple yet effective manner. Indeed, musicians, in the words of Jennifer Jack, have, and I quote, created true works of art by holding up a mirror to lawyers and to society so that we can see clearly the most comprehensive truths of our times. They have also transmitted feelings so that others can experience them, end quote. An American scholar, Aaron Lawrence, even goes further to categorically assert that music and law are two sides of the same coin. And I would like to quote him here. He says, when musicians remind the listener of the injustices in society, call for social change, or give their interpretation of legal theory, an image of the law is constituted, and that image often becomes the law. When musicians create music, they are simultaneously creating law. Their experiences, language, and motives encompass their being and develop an image of law. When listeners subsequently adopt, their lyrics constitute what law is for the people, which is often a direct response to the state's version of what law is or should be. Music is not similar to or a reaction to law. Rather, music is law. And I agree with him on that point. Now I go into the songs. The one area in which musicians have been able to critique the system is critiquing international system, reforms of global administration and global governance. An example is Fela Kuti in Beasts of No Nations, where Fela Kuti critiqued the veto rule in the United Nations. He actually labeled it animal sense, because his argument is that where one country can veto, exercise the right of veto, it's actually animal sense, it's illogical. He goes further to label the United Nations as a disunited nations, and he dismissed it in United Nations as egbekegbe, meaning a bad society or a bad grouping. In IMF, which is quite, it's an explicit song by Son Shirokuti. Here he had critiqued the IMF and other international financial institutions for their responsibility in the many sufferings and manipulation of the indebtedness of the third world. And I quote him here, then go pollute our land, call on foreign investment, international mother shut your mouth. Spread their lie through them, voice for government, international mother shut your mouth, the English translation. They pollute our land and call it foreign investment. Spread their lies through their allies in government. Regarding the issues that border on colonialism and neo-colonial practices, Huma Sekela, the late Huma Sekela, South African musician, in Vasco da Gama, highlight Vasco da Gama's role in the colonization process. And I quote him here, Vasco da Gama, he was no friend of mine. Vasco da Gama left Portugal to go to India to look for spices and emeralds. He went via Africa. He had to stop in South Africa to get water. He invented discovery for colonization. Similarly, in You Can't Blame the Youth, the late Jamaican reggae artist Peter Tosh implicated the education system for not calling out colonial imperial actors. I quote him again. So you can't blame the youth. You can't fool the youth. You can't blame the youth of today. You can't fool the youth. You teach the youth about Christopher Columbus, and you said he was a very great man. You teach the youth about Marco Polo, and you said he was a very great man. A more contemporary musician, Bonaboy, again follows in the strand in Monsters You Made, where he also called out Eurocentric teaching. He says they thought we were fools, would break their rules, skip their classes in school because of what their teachers are teaching, what white men are teaching, saying that they discovered River Niger. And he goes on to critique Mungo Park because they say Mungo Park discovered River Niger, discovered whatever that means. In here comes the judge, Peter Tosh, who created a criminal court process in which criminal and imperial actors such as Christopher Columbus, Vasco da Gama, David Livingston, John Constantine, Henry Morgan, Marco Polo, were prosecuted for their crimes. Similarly, in Teacher Don't Teach Me Nonsense, Fela Kuti provides an appraisal of the imposition of Western-style democracy on the developing world and its inconsistent application. I quote him here, Oyinbo dey no tell am himself that for England, army not to take over. English translation, why did the white people not tell the army, now he was referring to the Nigerian army, that in England, a military coup is an aberration. In Le Colonie, the French rapper MC Solar sings about the intersectionality of slavery, colonialism, and modern forms of exploitations and discriminations. In Piche Mi, Youssou N'Dou, the Senegalese musician, cautions African leaders against excessive reliance on foreign aid. As Lucas Keane noted, Youssou N'Dou in this song uses the allegory of a newborn bird who declines the offer of a crocodile to babysit until its mother returns to actually convey this message. Other songs that have explored the themes of corruption, illegal financial flows, environmental justice, etc. In International Thief Thief or International Thief Thief, Fela Kuti provides an illuminating and graphic explanation of how multinational corporations in collaboration with African elites illegally move money out of Africa. I quote him again, many foreign companies in Africa carry all our money go, then go write big English for newspaper dabber we Africans, then go cause confusion, cause corruption, cause oppression, cause inflation. English translation, many foreign companies operating in Africa illegally taking money out, then they will write complicated English words in newspapers to mask their criminality. As a result of this, they cause confusion, corruption, oppression, and inflation. The Ghanaian rappers, Sako Die and Manifest, in Brown Paper Bag, also touches on the similar thing, where they spoke about, you know, collusion of the manipulative role of Western elites, and also the pollution with national elite in fleecing their countries. Again, Bonaboy also touches on this in Monsters You Made. In Niger Delta, Nneka, the Nigerian musician, explores the role of multinational companies and national elites in the environmental degradation and misery of the peoples of Niger Delta region of Nigeria. She sang, and I quote her, now I'll just read the English translation. They have exhausted all the fishes in our waters. They are exploiting our crude oil. They have taken away our resources. They have taken away our riches. We have become the raw materials upon which they build their wealth. Tracy Chapman, in The Rape of the World, also touches on the idea of climate change and environmental degradation. And I quote her here, mother of us all, place of our birth, we are all witnesses to the rape of the world. You have seen our stripped mind. You have heard of bombs exploded on the ground. You know the sun shines hotter than ever before. Regarding the issues of refugees, IDPs, and migration, MIA in Borders sang about the problematic approach of the global north to migration from the global south, and how many global north politicians have actually, you know, been engaged in creating draconian migration policies to keep out migrants, to keep out asylum seekers and refugees from the global south. Based on their personal experiences, the Sierra Leone's refugee all-star in Living Like a Refugee paint a vivid picture of what it means to live like a refugee. I quote them here, you left your country to seek refuge in another man's land. You left your country to seek refuge in another man's land, you'll be confronted by strange dialect and you'll be fed with unusual diets. You've got to sleep in a tarpaulin house, which is so hot. You've got to sleep on a tarpaulin mat, which is so cold. In both journeys, the late Afrobeat musician, Tony Allen, sang about the precariousness of both migration to Europe, running away from, I quote it here, running away from misery, and you can find yourself in double misery. You don't decide to leave your misery behind from the past. It was shown in your country. You don't decide to leave your misery behind. Now you jump into the boat. Now you jump into the boat to cross the ocean with all your family, looking for a better situation across the ocean, but you never arrive. MC Solar touches on this, expands on it also in his song Le Polonie, the English translation here, because it was sung in French. He says, we have known the colonies, the Anthropophagous economy, the felony, the slave trade, the debt, the IMF, Bruno Jean-Marie, if I run, I have reasons, the same as the two skinny Negroes under a plane. On the themes of poverty, racism, inequality, and insecurity, musicians such as Femi Gidi, for example, in the song The World is Changing, laments the deepening and increasing state of global poverty. The Angolan Portuguese musician, Alin Farazao, in Primeiro Mundo, meaning first world, shows the racial prejudice faced by the citizens of the global south in the global north. I quote the English translation of the song. But inside it burns, how can it not? If I arrive in the first world, I feel more forgotten than in the second. It burns, the stamp of illegal racial prejudice, just because I was born for the south. In War, Bob Marley notes how racial discrimination, inequality, and injustice heightens the spirit of insecurity. The song, which is based on a 1963 United Nations speech given by the then Ethiopian Emperor Haile Selassie, and Bob Marley sings here, until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned, everywhere is war. In The God of Revolution, Tamar Naffar, Marwan Makul, Terence Sliman, in Arabic, highlighted the role of global powers in heightening the state of insecurity, and I quote them here. On the back of missiles, America exports modern justice daily. Russia objects, so it plants black roses on the warships along the coast of the East, so holy and so holy, full of slaughter. Now I move to the concluding part of the lecture, where I will show the methodological process of actually using music in rethinking the ideational and processual dimensions of international law in Africa. In advance the imperative of grasping law through music, Daniel Newman observed that music provides a valuable device to render what could be quite a dry and otherwise dull argument suddenly more interesting and thus engaging to the reader. This kind of engagement with international law is possible when music is effectively used as a mechanism for communicating and interpreting existential issues. As a communication mechanism, music assists us in the wider dissemination of problems, developments, and strategies for critical intervention. In this sense, it is at once repertorial, interrogative, and provocative. As an interpretive tool, music provides a multidimensional nuance perspective of understanding and approaching the challenges of international law and the international system. In understanding the ways in which music, in which the songs I've highlighted in this lecture and other related songs can serve as an important tool for reshaping and enhancing the critical understanding of international law in Africa, the exploratory potential of music must be given due attention. One way of doing this is to utilize music as an entree or introductory material for the better understanding of critical issues. In this respect, the persuasive rhythmic beats and the intense lyrics of socially conscious songs could serve as a gateway to grasping both the complexity and complexities of mainstream international law. Similarly, it could also provide an avenue for understanding the works of critical scholars and actors in reversing the melees. If available, the creative music videos of these songs could also provide some context and form part of the discursive materials for the better understanding of subjects and issues in international law. And this has been done by, I've come across some lecturers, for example, who have been able to use music videos to also highlight, especially music videos that speak to these themes to kind of further drive home the point. This engagement could serve as a valuable mechanism for popularizing and expanding the frontiers of the theoretical works of critical scholars among those that are interested in the critical understanding of the international system. As a gateway material, the insight gained from music will further assist in the in-depth assessment of latent and new issues of international law by probing the underlying complexities, engaging with the interdisciplinary and intersectional context of these issues, and adopting an open-minded approach to confronting these issues. On topics such as the reforms of the international system, environmental rights, migration, democracy, good governance, music could provide an alternative lens and context for engaging with linkages and relevance to current situations. This position actually has the potential of putting a face to the discursive issues and thus conscientizing participants. So you, going back to what I said in the introduction about the sentimental life of international, would put a face by showing the works of, exploring the lyrics of musicians to kind of say, yes, we are discussing this concept that seems abstract, but we could use music to further interrogate it. In the context of international legal education, for example, assignment and examination questions could be drafted in such a way that either presents an excerpt of socially conscious songs as a case study, or students are asked to explore the implications of the message of the songs for existing theories and approaches. Importantly, and this is a fact that we, even in our engagement with ideational approaches, we also have to understand that some of these musicians are social actors and activists, and they've experienced some of these things firsthand, and they could actually prove to be good resource persons for sharing their experiences and also engaging with a wider audience. This also applies to the dissemination of documentaries that capture their professional and personal engagement. An example of this is the famous 1982 documentary on the life and politics and music of Fela Kuti, which is called "And Music is the Weapon." It's freely available on YouTube, which again kind of explains his politics and some of the motivation behind some of his songs. Another example of a document, an important documentary, is called The African Underground, Democracy in Dakar, a documentary that explores the role of hip-hop and youth culture in challenging the controversial 2007 presidential elections in Senegal. And lastly, from South Africa, the famous Amandla, A Revolution in Four-Part Harmony, a 2002 documentary that explores the role of music in challenging apartheid. These are very important tools that could further explore the ideational issues in international law. Let me state here in conclusion that the points I have proposed in this lecture are by no means rigid prescriptions or ex cathedra. Rather, they are aimed at provoking further discussions and actions in this respect. And I should also add that I hope that I've at least ignited the zeal in some of you to create and share more playlists that speak to reimagining the state of international law. And that's why I had to give a playlist to Sandy here to put on the website to explain some of the songs that have inspired me to work on this. Our society and the body of scholarship can only benefit from approaches that ever stop questioning the status quo. Let me conclude this lecture by saying that if music be the food of rethinking and overhauling the idea of international law in Africa, please let no one press pause. It is morning yet on Creation Day of challenging international law, the challenging Eurocentric international law. Thank you all for your attention. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Babatunde. That was really a wonderfully rich lecture. I mean, there's so much food for thought there and so much for all of us to consider. So thank you so much.